Hi, I'm Keith Law. Welcome to episode 56 of The Keith Law Show. My guest today will be James Fagan, our White Sox writer here at The Athletic, to talk about some interesting White Sox storylines from Carlos Rodon to the Yerminator to some of the really interesting young players on that White Sox roster. First, we'd just like to let readers know, if you are a subscriber to The Athletic, and you should be, I've had two pieces related to the Major League Baseball draft go up in the last 5 days. Last week, I did a new ranking of the top 50 prospects in this year's draft class. And then on Monday morning, I had a post. I went down to UVA, Charlottesville, this weekend to see University of Louisville play the Cavaliers. And I have a post up on that, including asking the question of why Louisville catcher Henry Davis, who was fourth on my ranking last week, why isn't he the best prospect in this year's draft class? Why wouldn't we take an elite hitting catcher who absolutely can be an average defender, if not better, and stay behind the plate? Why wouldn't we take that guy over very good college pitchers, given the industry's belief that position players are safer than pitchers? So I profile Davis and talk about that question, talk about some of the other players I saw this weekend while down in Charlottesville. Would also like to remind everyone that my second book, The Inside Game, Bad Calls, Strange Moves, and What Baseball Behavior Teaches Us About Ourselves, is now out in paperback. You can buy it anywhere fine books are sold. If you would like an autographed copy, Midtown Scholar in Harrisburg, midtownscholar.com, does still have a handful of copies that I signed personally right when the book came out. You can order those directly from their website. Now it is my pleasure to be joined by my colleague James Fagan. He covers the White Sox for us here at The Athletic. You can follow him on Twitter at JRFEGAN. He is speaking to me fresh off of a tight Patriots Day game, a well-played Patriots Day game. James, how would you describe the Sox versus Sox tilt from Patriots Day?
Someone was tight. I don't know. Basically, I thought post-game, you know, the mystery that we'd be trying to solve would that, you know, this is kind of the first time since 2018 that anyone has really seemed that level of on time with Lucas Giolito's changeup. You know, you watch, I think the first game of the first changeup he threw of the game was this 0-2 changeup to Enrique Hernandez. And yeah, you look at the location, it was a mistake and it got hammered, and that's what's supposed to happen. But Lucas Giolito has been throwing changeup in mistake locations for a while now and getting really confused swings on it. And other than maybe one 0-1 changeup to JD Martinez, it looked like they knew it was coming every single time. And, you know, post-game, people really didn't have a lot of answers for it. Lucas just said it was the worst he had executed them all year and kind of blamed it for that. And, you know, maybe that could be so if he's saying that. And maybe we'll learn a lot more about what was wrong when he kind of figures it out and fixes it the next time out. That's kind of, we knew a lot more about what was wrong in the 2018 season and 2019 when he had kind of fixed everything. And, you know, one of the reasons that this outlet kind of does good work is that we do kind of wait to see how things play out a little bit and not just rush for immediate 20-minute reaction. But it was really strange. And I thought it would be a lot more, you know, trying to figure out what was at the heart of it. I'm kvetching about it, my colleagues at this point. It didn't seem like we were trying to get to the root of a mystery. But, yeah, that's a team built around a lot around the idea that this guy is going to be an absolute frontline starter. They don't have this, you know, endless weapon of like Legion of Arms where everyone can kind of give 140 good innings and they'll be fine. So any kind of crack in the armor for Giolito or any sort of inconsistency for him puts the White Sox in a bad way. So having him correct that immediately, especially given that literally his last time out, he threw 7 scoreless innings. Is a big imperative for them.
Yeah, I just from seeing some of the I call them highlights on Twitter, I wondered if were they picking it up. Like I always hate the he was tipping his pitches, because anytime I hear that from a coach as an explanation for a guy having a bad outing, it just immediately my sensors go up. But either one, it's just an excuse. Right. Or two, there's something else going on and you just don't want to tell us. It's the easiest thing to say, oh, we saw something. We saw he was tipping his pitches. We're not going to tell you what it was, but we saw it. And you just have to trust us in this. Now, I know they didn't say that today, but I actually thought, you know, maybe I'm like, I've been in the industry too long. And now I'm starting to think that way. They've co-opted me and I'm falling for this. But it was like, wait, the changeup's nobody sees his changeup. You know, Mike Trout 2 weeks ago was telling him it was one of the best pitches he'd ever seen. And then today it seemed like Boston was just on it. And I don't know. I don't even necessarily, this isn't even necessarily a question. It was just sort of watching it. It was like, wow, they really, you just said it, right? You just said it seemed like they knew what was coming, and it kind of looked like that.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, he's added some action to it this season. Mm-hmm. He's getting more arm side run on it, and I almost asked him like a couple times at the first couple games, like, do you want that? I mean, it's almost like, almost the beauty of it was that it was just, you know, straight floating in and tunneled everything off your heater as much as possible. But yeah, it's something that's gotten by purely off deception for so long. I remember like his first good start in 2019 in Kansas City. Alex Gordon even said post game was like, you know, it's not that good, but I couldn't see it. I didn't know it was coming. Like, it's just like this, he had really good deception on it. It was very strange. It was very aberrant to have that level of just everybody picking it up and sitting on it and timing it right. You know, when he gives the home runs off his changeup, you know, in the past, the last couple of years, it's just been like, well, they must have guessed because nobody picks it up. And yeah, you know, most hitters are guess hitters at this point, and that's going to happen. But you didn't see it with the consistency you saw today. So it was a really weird game. And it's, you know, other I wind up following what interests me in this job a lot. And that may not be what's always trending in the news cycle, but this is a game that's like, that was strange. Mm-hmm. I want to figure out what was happening there. And, you know, maybe in 5 days he will just annihilate the Texas Rangers, which one might not prove anything, but two could provide a lot of answers for what was going on there.
Actually, will he line up against Dane Dunning? Dunning pitched yesterday.
I think Cease is lined up against Dunning.
Okay. I was going to say that would be very interesting. I mean, it's early. I'm not reading anything into this. I'm sure White Sox fans are seeing Dunning pitching pretty well. And didn't Lynn just hit the injured list? And it's like, well, right. Yeah, everything's going wrong, right? Like, the sky's falling in the south side of Chicago, obviously. When I first reached out to you to ask you to do the podcast, it was in the wake of Carlos Rodon throwing a no-hitter, obviously a much happier moment for White Sox fans. And I just find, and you wrote about that for us right after the game, and I just find his whole arc fascinating because there was a point maybe 2 years ago where it was, is this guy ever going to be healthy and effective enough to be a big league starter? So he went from his sophomore year in college, the best prospect in the country in the draft, didn't have a great junior year, and then just sort of like gradually down, shoulder surgery, Tommy John surgery, comes back, not throwing as hard, not throwing as well. And now this year, this is the guy he was his first 2 years at North Carolina State. He's completely rejuvenated. So kind of give us a sense of what you've seen and learned from talking to people there about Rodon turning back into the guy he was always destined to become.
I will say, like, it was easy to miss because, one, he was very ineffective, and two, I think his second start last year, he left with an injury where, like, it was shoulder stiffness and his velo just started falling off a cliff, and that was kind of clued you wrong. I think he was throwing 86 by the second inning. But the velo was back post Tommy John surgery to some degree. He was throwing like 95 in their intra-squad games. I think that Cleveland relief appearance where he absolutely got lit up, and I thought he was talking to us on Zoom that this was the last time I was ever going to see Carlos Rodon because he had just been thrown in this awful situation. They clearly thought him as a reliever, and you know, it just went horribly. And like, what do you use him as now? Because you always thought like, if everything goes wrong, Carlos Rodon, you can throw him in the bullpen, and you know, it didn't seem like that was a good path either. He hit like 99 in that game. So the fact that the velo was back wasn't the hugest surprise. Mm. But even when he came back in 2020 with the velocity, it was still like the same, you know, poorly commanded, not exceptional ride fastball that, you know, he would get hammered if he didn't locate it right, which he frequently did not. And, you know, it was still basically everything is just trappings to set up the slider, which has been Carlos Rodon's, you know, professional career. Everything this offseason was about doing a lot of the things that, you know, not change up his arm swing so much, but doing a lot of things that Lucas Giolito kind of had to, you know, get the life and action and response on his four seamer that he did. It was a lot of core velocity belt training. It was, weighted ball, work with Ethan Katz. It was a lot of these things them touting that he's going to get carry back on his fastball and he's going to be able to use it as a weapon again. And throughout spring training, if spring training means anything, which you usually know, you saw it. you see a lot of things in spring training that don't mean anything, but you saw him throwing his four-seamer by people. You saw him kind of leading with that being a pitch that he could use to not just kind of tokenly get ahead, but finish people off with, and that, you know, teams had to plan a game around that, that he could throw his changeup off of it. And it wasn't like, I remember asking him in early 2019 when he's having a modicum of success, when he's throwing that slider 45, 50 times a game, and I was just like, maybe you could just be Patrick Corbin and just do that. And he was like taken aback by that. Like, that did not like seem like an approach he thought he could really lean into. He's just like, this is a temporary thing. I didn't have my best fastball today. That's why I threw the slider a ton. But, you know, my fastball's coming back. Don't worry about it. A month later, he's under the knife. So now he's pitching the way that he kind of foresaw, you know, back then. You know, obviously, a ton of stuff has happened. You know, a ton of adjustments have been made. But the end of that no-hitter, he didn't have his best slider that entire game. His slider was a lot better against Seattle in his first start. It wasn't, you know, the command of a slider, you know, sure enough, cost him the perfect game because he, you know, bounced it.
Right, and back-footed.
Literally back-footed Carlos Perez. It was all about the fact that he just, when he got into a bad count, when the chips were down, he could throw his four-seamer by people, which is something you really haven't seen his professional career. And that was not just about having the velocity again, though I think the pitch he threw in the ninth inning, I think I wrote it, 98.8, was literally the fastest pitch he had thrown in 4 years. Yeah. It was about the action on it. And it's two games. He looked good in spring. It's whatever. You know, the first 180 inning season he throws will be his first, but it's a different looking guy. And, you know, this is literally his first nine inning complete game. I'm not saying he's an ace now. I'm not saying he's, you know, Lance Lynn, take your time because you have a new number three starter, but it's something to look at. It's different from what you've seen. You got to, you know, give some respect to it. And I don't think it's just because he threw a no hitter. I think it's because he looks better.
It's interesting to me because my history with Rodon goes, it's really before he got to the big leagues. Like I said, the first time I saw him was the summer before his draft year. So he was pitching for Team USA and it was the best amateur slider I'd ever seen. It might still be the best amateur slider I've ever seen. But what you were just talking about his fastball prior to the changes he appears to have made was even true back then. He'd throw hard. I have a pretty good memory of him throwing 97 pretty regularly. I don't know that he got harder than that, but it was like not a great fastball. It's weird to discuss that as well. It was 97, but you know, it's not that great, right? But that's, as it turns out, especially with the evolution of velocity in general in the big leagues, you can throw 97 and have it be not a terribly effective pitch if it doesn't have span or movement or life or in his case, I don't think it had much deception because of the way his delivery worked. So it was, this guy's got an elite slider and at the time had a really good track record as an amateur starter. I don't know that anybody, including myself, really thought, well, is that enough, right? Is that slider by itself enough to say this guy's a potential number one or number two starter? So the package that he offers today, as you've described it now, I know you don't want to say he's clearly, you know, based on two starts in spring training, that this is what he is. But if I were regrading him as a prospect today, based on what you described, I'd probably like him more because it's not just the slider. And if he doesn't want to throw the slider, doesn't think he should throw the slider 40 to 50 times a game, like you just said, well, now he's got something else he can work with. And the slider is there when he needs it, but it doesn't have to be his primary pitch, a la Patrick Corbin.
Right. And, you know, obviously part of saying a guy's number one or number two is consistency, mm-hmm. you know, track record and durability.
Durability, for sure.
Those are all things that, you know, are unchecked for him at this point.
Yeah, that's – and we don't know, right? I obsess about this a little bit is, hey, this player's qualified for the ERA title once in his career. Why do we think he's going to be able to do it this year or, you know, twice in the next 3 years or in the case when someone hands out a long-term contract to a player? This guy, if you don't have a track record of health, why should we assume you'll have a track record of health? And, I mean, that was the – you know, I think that's come up with a lot of these – you know, part of the problem that the White Sox are having with – lack of depth right now is that they were maybe a little bit banking on guys who don't have great, who don't have track records of both health and effectiveness. They have guys who have track records of one or the other, but not many guys on this roster, I'm thinking even more of the pitching staff, who could offer you both.
Right, and that could extend to, you know, Eloy Menez, I think, when he got hurt. I just, like, opened a Google Doc and I started typing all these anecdotes of, like, times he got hurt or missed a couple of games that I could remember offhand. I had was up to 8
oh, God.
By the time I, like, got to it. But yeah, I don't do what you do for a living, but, you know, something that was always described about him to me was that, you know, delivery was stiff and mm-hmm. that he kind of didn't, you know, finish in a smooth way.
I agree.
I felt like you could see it. I felt like you could feel a really stiff, like, cutoff that his legs would get to a certain point and not drive through the way you want it. That was another thing that they said that they worked on a lot in the offseason, that it was all about, you know, feeling that he was putting more stress on his legs and not on his shoulder. And that was what the optimism that, you know, along with, you know, trimming a little bit of weight and feeling like he was better conditioned, that was something that was going to bode well to him staying healthy, not just, you know, selling out and getting more velo and having more life, but, you know, it still could wear down, or, you know, everything's gonna you know, pop after 60 innings or something like that. That was part of their optimism. Mm-hmm. Again, I feel like everybody says I'm getting into my legs more in my delivery in spring training.
Yep.
It's there's so much road to go. There's so much more he has to prove, but I think it merits watching.
Yeah, it's the proof will be in the proof is in the pitching, right? Like, if he continues to at least pitch, hold his stuff, be durable, he's not going to doesn't have to pitch at this level. But yeah, if he thinks he's using his legs more, and there are probably things we can look at. You know, that's why I like to go watch pitchers from the side too, to see where they land and where is the arm, where, you know, where is their hand position when the front leg strikes. There are little things you can look at, but ultimately the proof is, does he hold up? If he holds up, then that would at least support the contention that he's using his legs more. And I agree with what you described. I remember the scout who first pointed this out to me. We were walking out of that same Rodon outing when he was in college and talking about how great the slider was. He said, I've never seen a pitcher who was at that level who landed that stiffly. He thought it was like, he's never going to hold up. And I was like, I'm not a good enough scout to tell you that, but it always stuck in my mind. That scout had a pretty good track record. But he absolutely thought, you know, that's going to have to change at some point. And I would say if he continues to hold up, it's at least an indicator that they've made that change. That's assuming that the delivery was part of why he got hurt in the first place. Well, if he manages to stay healthy and especially hold this kind of velocity, then it means it's actually worked. I think it would be another feather in Katz's cap too. I mean, I think they're doing some really good, interesting things with pitchers, which is not something you've been able to say about the White Sox for a while now.
Yeah, you know, Katz was very adamant that, you know, Rodon was spinning on his toe too much, mm-hmm. that he was, you know, putting everything on his quadricep. And, you know, I don't know if the fixes he's going to put in are going to be, you know, address all of them. But the fact that they're aware and there's something that they're actively trying to combat is progress. I feel like maybe, you know, obviously Don Cooper had a very outstanding career. You don't last too long without being good,
right,
during your peak. And I'm sure 15 years from now, if Ethan Katz is still talking about core velocity belts, people are going to be looking at him like, what are you,
yeah, right.
Dinosaur? What are you doing?
You know, peak about? Don Cooper was one of the best, right? It was a joke.
Right.
Well, just send a guy to the White Sox, Don Cooper will give him a cutter and he'll win the Cy Young Award.
Yeah, I'm sure if just from what he did in the mid-2000s, yeah. If I just sorted by, you know, pitcher F war and what his entire tenure, where the White Sox rank, I think they were still in the top 10.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, a lot of that was a while ago, but, you know, pitching coaches seem to have their primes just like pitchers, and maybe they're getting shorter just like pitchers'
yeah.
primes are.
Yeah, like all of us, I would guess.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV.
Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
So we got to talk about the Yerminator. I held off as long as I could, but he pitched today. He's just adding to his legend. Also, you wrote a really good piece on him that I think was actually published Monday morning. You know, Mercedes kind of kicked around for a while. A bunch of people asked me, like, why wasn't this guy ever a prospect? My biggest answer for them was he was kind of old for everywhere he played. And look at it, right? That's generally not what the best prospects look like. You know, what did you learn? What do you see from him? Obviously, he's not going to hit 400 the rest of the season. Not crazy, but do you see a role for this guy? Do you think he could be? Is there a way to expand him as his offensive performance comes back down to earth? Are there ways that they could deploy him where he could still be helpful?
I don't really know. Like,
it's a good answer.
It's like the reason he'd get dinged as a prospect is what? He's old and he has no defensive position. Yeah, right now, right. He's excelling in the majors. He's an old rookie and he has no defensive position. Yeah. you know, I'm sure you have heard your share. I know I've heard my share of defensive criticisms of Zach Collins, and that's clearly the guy they trust more than Yermín Mercedes behind the plate.
Yeah.
Like, Zach Collins is the backup catcher on that team.
Right.
Yermín Mercedes has not caught a game yet.
Yeah.
They've said that they're comfortable with him, but, you know, the proof is in the fact that you, like, have refused to put him back there in any way, and he's a guy who, at this point, is getting him into the lineup, you know, the hardest way you can through DH. And you know, he's played left field, he's played third base in the minors, he's played first base, he's played all over. None of these are places for a guy who's red hot as they come that they're willing to play at this point. And this is a team that's got, you know, has given multiple starts to Billy Hamilton. This is a team that's played Jake Lamb in left field the other day. This is a team that has Andrew Vaughn playing in left field. This is not a team that's like unimaginative about where they can slide guys in to get a good bat or a bat that they think is going to be good into the lineup.
Yep.
So the fact that they're still hesitant about Yermín, you know, says a lot.
Yeah.
And he's definitely willing. He's probably not quite as slow as you think he is exactly off looking at him. And he definitely has a powerful arm, but yeah, there seems to be a lot of hesitance about how much they trust him. You know, he definitely has a big throwing arm behind the plate, but it didn't seem like as much work as they've done. It didn't seem like the best blocker in spring training or anything like that. Definitely saw some pass balls that seemed like, you know, bad technique or, you know, getting crossed up and, you know, stuff that big league catchers just don't do more than once in a blue moon at this level. I don't know. I think it's very dependent on the bat. And if you get someone to kind of defend Yermín, you know, it's usually this saying, hey, you could always hit. And right now, he does look like he could hit. He's not going to hit 400, but I'm a fan, or at least fascinated by the two-strike approach. You don't really see guys go from like almost Daniel Palka, the biggest leg kick I've ever seen, biggest hand load I've ever seen, to a no-stride two-strike swing that really keeps them in counts. You're seeing a bit more vulnerability as people are working him inside. You're seeing a bit more people pairing that with, you know, I want to say horizontal breaking cutters that, you know, Eovaldi threw him at today, really gave him a lot of problems. I definitely don't think he can maintain I would be surprised even by a sub 20 strikeout percentage over the course of a full season.
Mm-hmm.
But he's got some things that he does to try to keep himself alive that are really interesting that I think, I don't know if it's going to make him, he can make a living as a DH and he's going to just be, you know, Nelson Cruz the rest of his life, but given that the production was there in the minors, given what he's done early on, it seems like he's going to hit at a major league level or, you know, around like an average-ish level. I just don't know if that's a guy you just salt away the DH spot to indefinitely and just say like, well, as long as we're batting Yermín every day, we're great and has a career, because it doesn't look like there's a defensive home outside of that. So I think it's what you would say about any prospect. It's what you'd say about Andrew Vaughn, you know, coming up. It's like, that dude's going to have to hit, and he's going to have to keep hitting, because I don't know what he does if he's not hitting. He's not providing you a ton of value.
Wanted to ask you about two rookies on the roster this year. One was Vaughn. Just early impressions. I don't know if you'd gotten a chance to see him much at all prior to this spring. Last time I saw him was just over 2 years ago when he and Adley Rutschman had a series where they faced each other. And what am I going to say, right? They were both great prospects. It was pretty obvious. I walked away saying, yep, those are probably two best college guys in the draft. Okay, that's kind of what they're supposed to look like as hitters. But then, you know, the part I find so interesting about Vaughn is they sign him. He finishes that summer in high A, which is actually good, but was very aggressive. And he was just fine there.
Right.
And I was fairly sure. It's like, all right, they'll probably slow it down now once games resume to let him get his feet under him and wait to see if some more power develops, if they have to make adjustments. Instead, it's, nope, we got a need. Boom. He's right in the big leagues. So we've seen the defense hasn't been great in left field so far, but really what have you seen from him more at the plate in terms of approach, or what kind of power do you think we might see from him? What kind of production, I should say, in general, do you think we'll see from him the rest of the year?
I don't know. He looks overmatched right now, and I know that's fine given where his track record, given that he hasn't had a full minor league season at any point. I saw him in Winston-Salem too when he was fine.
Okay,
you know, it looked like the approach was really solid. It looked like he didn't, you know, expand the zone, but I didn't see him get super hot.
Mm-hmm.
I saw all the ingredients of a really solid hitter, but I didn't see like a guy like, all right, he's dominating. Mm-hmm. He's overqualified. Get him out of here. And, you know, I don't do prospect stuff for a living, but I've seen Eloy Jimenez hit at high A, and I know what that looked like, and it wasn't at that level.
Right.
I see, like, he's drawing a lot of walks because he's really, you know, he's not overly aggressive. He's really spitting on a lot of close pitches. He has a really good idea doing it at the plate. All the things that people said when they were justifying the idea of giving this assignment to him would carry him through the day, that he had this solid plate approach he wouldn't break from. I see a lot of him getting his pitch to hit and fouling it off.
Yep.
I see a lot of something that was touted to me was that what made him different from any other hitter is that he's so calm, that he trusts in his approach, that he has he doesn't miss mistakes. He doesn't waste pitches. He doesn't get too revved up and foul pitches back when it's his time to jump on him. I feel like I've seen a lot of that. I feel like I've seen a lot of pitches in the zone where he's worked it kind of his favor, where he's forced him to throw a cutter or a fastball in on his hand, something to challenge him. And I've seen him either swing through it or foul it back. And I know that's not what he's supposed to do long term. I know this is an extremely early approach. I know he's not getting to play every day, which seems a little counterintuitive. If you're giving your best hitting prospect this opportunity in the majors, you think that the best outcome at the end of September is going to be Andrew Vaughn acclimated to the majors, being productive, don't you need to race to that opportunity by giving as many opportunities as possible? He hasn't been getting that. It's a lot of earn your at bats talk while Jake Lamb or Billy Hamilton plays instead. And yeah.
If listeners did not see the face I was making I could watch Billy Hamilton run all day. I don't think we really need to see him with a bat in his hand.
I think my observation I said about Hamilton is that his numbers always they wind up underwhelming me, because I think Billy Hamilton, I know he's not a hitter, and then if he gets like a hit or two in a game, I'm like, oh my god,
whoa, yes,
right. He's doing it. And then I look back at his numbers, like, oh right, he's hitting 250 with not many walks, right, and no power. That's not great. So what do I think when I'm seeing a guy foul pitches off that I think everything you hear him about, he should be able to hammer it? I would assume that with time, with acclimation, those should turn into doubles. You know, there should be more home runs. You saw him, I think, short arm a really, tough fastball up and in from Urihara in spring training that made you think, like, this guy's got the hand speed and the power to really do this and succeed. But that hasn't happened in the majors just yet with the inconsistency and whatnot. I assume it happens at some point. I've read too many great things about him from scouts who are way better than me to say, like, oh, turns out actually this guy can't hit because I saw him struggle in 10 major league games. But I don't know. They've got to kind of pick a direction of this. Either, he is going to go back to AAA after a rough April and maybe find his footing and really get in a rhythm and maybe come back midseason, or you've got to just kind of bear through it right now in the majors, let it happen. And I don't know how much of it is with Eloy Jimenez out, you're kind of searching for offense wherever you can get it a little bit. And the offense, I think overall, they're fine. And certainly seen some promising progress from Luis Robert, but they're not at this juggernaut level where you can just have a level of a slot in the lineup that's just struggling every day for a month and you kind of don't sweat it. Because I think right now they're really looking for some sort of rhythm wherever they can find it. With Jose Abreu not hitting well, with Yamankata not hitting well, with, you know, really not a lot of uncertainty of how you're going to replace Jimenez's production. Vaughn not hitting the ground running is not giving an opportunity. And your Mercedes is hitting the ground running.
Yep.
Didn't think he was going to make the team, but now he's, you know, irreplaceable.
Yep.
Has thrown the whole picture into a lot more flux than I think we anticipated.
So the last guy I wanted to ask about real quick was Garrett Crochet, who White Sox fans, well, a lot of White Sox fans didn't understand why he wasn't on my top 100. And my argument was basically, I think he's a reliever. And he's been really good in that role, but it's been a little different than I expected, at least, where he's been throwing a lot of fastballs, but he's missing more bats with the slider. And there's really not a third pitch to speak of there. Do you think this is – I'm really most interested. You can tell me what you've seen from him. But also, is this kind of what he'll be this year? Do you get the sense that it's like not one inning, you know, or maybe even moving into more high leverage spots, but he's missing bats in this role. We might as well leave him here, especially because he's had some health issues in the past when he was still in college that might limit him innings-wise in the short term.
Well, if I had to hit upon the biggest – geez, there's so many sources of White Sox fan angst.
True.
Maybe Crochet isn't even top 10. But he's sitting like 96, 97 this year. And he was 101 coming out of the bullpen. Just, there wasn't a lot going on, but blowing people's doors off.
Yep.
But he was as good as a god at blowing people's doors off last year. This year, it's been kind of weird because he's obviously not going to get the same, you know, just absolute helpless swings on the fastball at that velocity. The slider in some of his early appearances was really really solid.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a little consistent at times. In spring training, Katz was saying that they're really struggling with him throwing it as a curveball. It lost a lot of velo, went down to low 80s, and was getting more loopy. They felt like they were progressing towards sharpening it and getting back to that slider action, and with it more high 80s action. But you've seen it be a little inconsistent. He got a swing and miss off the changeup the other day, but it was a 92-mile-an-hour changeup when he's sitting 96, 97 with the fastball. So, yeah, you kind of it's obviously not a finished product by any means. It's not where the point where I'd start saying, like, hey, you know, put some respect on Garrett Crochet's changeup name. It's obviously something he's willing to throw and they're trying to work on, but it's with the weirdness of the velo, which they've always said, like, you know, we expect it to tick up over the course of the season. You know, we're not worried about it. And the fact that this changeup is still very hard, it's kind of a weird package to look at. They've defended it, basically saying that he's not getting, you know, hard hit or anything like that. And that's true.
Yeah.
But this is a day and an age where if you're not missing bats, if you're not striking out guys at almost 30% clip, you better have, a dynamite sinker, getting insane ground ball rates, doing something with your contact profile that's very unique, be Aaron Bummer. Or, something's kind of up, and right now it's been kind of a little consistent. I don't think, with the fact that the velo's down, with the fact that you are not seeing, the Michael Kopech level consistency at this point. Michael Kopech level consistency. It's weird. That's
I know, crazy. Right? But look at him.
But,
looks
but look
great.
At him. They already seemed hesitant or not inclined to really stretch him out. I think Tony La Russa, said at the beginning of spring, like, this is part of a late inning mixture. This is not a guy that we're going to graduate towards starting this season. He basically just has so few innings under his belt that they couldn't imagine ramping him up in any way. Like, really, a 60 to 70 inning reliever season is such a big jump to what he did, his college career, that, even that's something that has to be carefully managed. I think it's going to be 1 to 2 inning bursts over the course of the season. And it's really about, does the life on all of his stuff, does the consistency of the shape of his stuff hold up under that?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really before you start thinking about him being starter next year, which is something they've talked about semi ambitions for. But the question I was asking is, if this guy's really a standout reliever over the course of the season and he's really good at this role, how do you just walk away from that, from what are still kind of shaky odds that he really sticks as a rotation? You're going to take away one of your best relievers, a best left-handed reliever, and basically probably would still need some minor league seasoning or be have a really rough season in the majors starting next year. Are you going to walk away from a bullpen piece while you're contending to do that? That seems really unlikely.
Yep.
They said, let us get to that point. And, if he's a successful reliever, that's a good problem. That's the way Rick Hahn put it. it's going to be quite a journey to get there in the first place to see what he looks like in the season. So starting him, it's hard to look that far at this point.
Yeah, I agree. He's not like where Chris Sale was after Sale spent some time in the bullpen, moved to the rotation. Sale's stuff was better, and I think Sale's command and control were a lot better at the same at the analogous point in their development.
Right, and you have to allow for the fact that maybe Chris Sale is a little bit more unique.
Yes, in so many ways. Yes, he is.
You know, that's probably a lesson that was taught when you drafted college pitchers and sent them right to the majors really quick with Carl Swindon and Carson Fulmer in the years after Sale. That maybe that process was not as repeatable as, you know, once hoped.
Yep, absolutely. My guest today has been James Fagan. He is our White Sox reporter. You can find his stuff on The Athletic. Like as I said earlier, he has great pieces up just in the last week on Carlos Rodon and on the Yerminator, Yermin Mercedes. You can and should follow James on Twitter at JRFEGAN. James, thank you so much for joining me.
Happy to be here.
That's all for this week's show. Thank you so much for listening. If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with a friend. And if you happen to listen on iTunes, please go and give us a review and a rating. Prefer 5 stars, but if it's not 5 stars, let me know why, and I'll try to fix it. No promises. Thanks so much for listening. Stay safe, everybody, and go get that vaccine.